NCAA Final Four in Detroit, with enshrinement in September at the Hall of Fame in Springfield, Massachusetts. Jordan is regarded by many as the greatest player in history. He, of course, led the Bulls to 6 NBA titles and was a 5-time NBA MVP and a 6-time NBA Finals MVP. Also among the finalists is Johnny Red Kerr, a longtime Chicago Bulls commentator who was named NBA Coach of the Year in 1967 after leading the expansion Bulls to the playoffs in their first season. And, of course, Kerr played collegiate ball at University of Illinois, the highlight of his collegiate career in 1952 when he helped the Fighting Illini win the Big Ten Championship and advance to the NCAA Final Four. And there is news that Bulls general manager John Paxson is still on the job today despite mounting criticism of the team's performance and his ability to make necessary personnel moves to field a contender. Although the Bulls have played better of late, they're 10th in the Eastern Conference and 4th in the Central Division at 23-30. The Chicago Sun-Times reported on its website today that Paxson would step down, but the timing isn't certain. Meanwhile, the Chicago Tribune reported he was strongly considering resigning, likely at the end of the year. Team spokesman Tim Hallman said today that Paxson has not quit and that he was in Phoenix for the league's competition committee meeting. Paxson did not return calls to his cell phone. The Tour of California bicycle race begins tomorrow in Sacramento. This would not normally generate a lot of attention outside the cycling community, except that this year the field includes Lance Armstrong. The 9-day tour is Armstrong's first major road race in the United States since he announced he was coming out of retirement last year. Here's NPR's Tom Goldman.
Race organizers expect a whopper of a crowd at tomorrow's start of the Tour of California, up to 75,000 people. Even in a downtown Sacramento hotel yesterday, there was a palpable buzz. A big crowd of reporters hubbubbed as they waited for a dream press conference with some of cycling's top stars in recent years. Tyler Hamilton, Ivan Basso, Floyd Landis, and of course, Lance Armstrong. To the skeptics in the crowd, it was also a rogues gallery of doping. Hamilton, Basso, and Landis all were suspended for alleged banned drug use. Armstrong was dogged by allegations, all which he denied, during his streak of 7 straight Tour de France victories. Reporters hoping for an honest group session on doping, think Alex Rodriguez times 4, were disappointed. Hamilton said he's not looking back. Basso spoke in Italian about things other than drugs, and Landis, who was stripped of his 2006 Tour de France title, crashed during practice.
Fortunately, he is okay. He's pretty bruised up. His hip is okay, and we expect him to start the race on Saturday.
So that left Master of Ceremonies Michael Roth, who works for the company putting on the race, to introduce the man everyone really turned up for. Lance Armstrong sat on the dais wearing a dark T-shirt and an off-white baseball cap pulled low. He calmly fielded a few questions about doping until he called on Paul Kimmage. He's a reporter for the Sunday Times of London and a professed anti-doping crusader. Kimmage thinks Landis and Basso were guilty of doping despite their claims of innocence, and he criticized Armstrong for welcoming them back after their suspensions recently ended.
What is it about these dopers that you seem to admire so much?
Excuse me? What is your name again?
My name is Paul Kimmage. I work for the Sunday Times. I asked for an interview, but I didn't get one.
Armstrong, a cancer survivor who said his comeback in large part was to raise global awareness about the disease, was controlled but angry as he explained to Kimmage why he didn't grant an interview.
When I decided to come back, for what I think is a very noble reason. You said, folks, the cancer has been in remission for 4 years, but our cancer has now returned, meaning me. So I think it goes without saying, no, we're not going to sit down and do an interview. You are not worth the chair that you're sitting on with a statement like that.
Later, after the press conference, Kimmage said he was disappointed that Armstrong portrayed him as being insensitive to those with cancer. Kimmage, who rode in 3 Tours de France, says he merely wants to rid the sport he loves of the cancer of doping. He worries that with Armstrong, Landis, Basso, and Hamilton back on the scene, cycling will slip backwards after making recent progress on the drug front. Tour of California race organizers say they've done everything in their power to ensure a clean race. Whether someone admits or not, says one official, is neither here nor there for us. Tom Goldman, NPR News, Sacramento.
Hello, Yael.
Don, where are you?
I'm behind this door.
How did you know it was me?
I recognized your voice, of course.
Did you know dolphins can recognize each other in a similar way? Only instead of using voices, they use whistles.
Whistles?
Dolphins are social mammals that have evolved to live in an aquatic environment. Like bats, they can use sonar to locate prey by emitting different frequencies of broadband sounds called clicks. But it wasn't until the 1990s that scientists discovered that they have another kind of sound that they use for communication. That sound is a pure narrowband tone that's frequency is modulated up and down. We call it a whistle.
Why do they need whistles?
Dolphins live in groups, usually mothers with calves or adult males with each other. Individuals in these groups help each other with hunting, scouting for food sources, or protecting each other. Since ocean water is difficult to see through, they have adopted whistles as a way to keep in touch with each other. But these whistles are not just a way to greet each other. Each individual dolphin has its own signature whistle, like I have a voice that identifies me. When individuals get separated from each other, they will whistle to let other dolphins know not only where they are, but who they are.
That's amazing, Don.
Well, dolphins are amazing animals. Like humans, they have large brains for their body size. We are just starting to understand how intelligent they really are.
This moment of science comes from Indiana University, with production support from the Brabson Foundation.
Today's program was prepared by Susan Linville, with help from Randall Wells at the Moat Marine Laboratory. There are hundreds more moments of science on our website at amos.indiana.edu. For a moment of science, I'm Don Glass.
And I'm Yael Cassander.
It's 2:47, and you're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Jay Pierce, in for Celeste Quinn today. 1 year ago tomorrow, a man stepped onto the stage of a lecture hall at Northern Illinois University and opened fire, killing five students, then himself. He wounded several others that day. In the wake of the shooting, the university promised it would move forward and learn from the tragedy. Tony Arnold reports on what NIU learned and that it may have benefits for other institutions.
In the hours after the shooting, as national and international media converged on the rural college town of DeKalb, Illinois, university officials and the police held press conferences. In one of the first, President John Peters made an emotional connection with the school's 25,000 students.
"And do what I can personally to help them through this. And they'll help me through this."
These days, the general feeling is Peter's personal approach was successful, comforting in the short run, and helping mend the university over time. Peter's met with students and with families of the victims, something he says he'd heard other school leaders had not done after similar tragedies. But as he talks about it now, Peter says that intimate persona, kind of like a father figure, is one he reluctantly took on.
"That's very old-fashioned because, you know, the university is a place where you go and you get your mind tested and you get stretched and be the best you can be. But I found myself slipping into that role because it was a way I could relate to them."
Within just a few hours of the shooting by former student Stephen Kazmierczyk, many students had already left DeKalb for home. Some of the few who remained visited a makeshift memorial by the Student Center. They quietly laid candles, individual flowers, and random NIU gear on top of a mound of snow.
"One of my friends, he's in that class, and he actually ditched today, and it ended up obviously being a good thing that he did ditch."
"Like, I've just heard so many different things that I just want to know the truth now."
"The response time today was quick."
"Yeah."
"But, you know, you can't, even if you got here in 30 seconds, you can hurt a lot of people."
Many students agree that NIU's initial response was handled well, as were the following days and months. Classes were canceled for a week, faculty attended counseling workshops, and administrators tried to get campus back up and running with a sense of normalcy. President Peters says all that attributed to the recovery. I met with Peters for about half an hour last week in his office. He told me later he had around 25 such interviews scheduled. Peters has been president of NIU for almost 9 years. He started his career as a scholar of public policy in Congress. During our visit, Peters points out the phone where he took the call from then-President Bush. And when he talks about last Valentine's Day, some of that emotion from before is still evident.
it is constantly on my thoughts. Not that, you know, I have other things to do, university, and I do them, but it is ever present with me.
Does that bother you?
No, I've learned to accept it.
Peter says his university had an emergency system in place for such an event, from sending mass emails to website communications, and everyone did their jobs well. He attributes that preparedness to the mass shootings at Virginia Tech less than a year before, and the widespread adoption of emergency plans by his and other universities. He says NIU's legacy is how to recover in the event of a mass tragedy, and he says it will happen.
So every time there is an incident, and unfortunately there are these random, senseless acts of violence that no one can anticipate, we are quick to offer our support as to how you deal with it in the early hours and then the aftermath.
Peter says he supports those seeking prevention, whether by public policy or academic studies on human behavior. But they only go so far. So Peters is preparing for the next school shooting, wherever it may be, and he says he wants NIU's unique contribution to be all that it has learned about recovery. Sam Brunell can attest to that. She's now a sophomore broadcast journalism major. Brunell was in the classroom that was attacked, and she says she's noticed her professors have given her individual attention.
They understand, you know, I'm not just a student here. You know, it's kind of different that way.
Brunell is quick to add, while she can't escape the memory of the shooting, that one event doesn't define NIU or her time at the university. I'm Tony Arnold.
It is true that Hollywood is always on the lookout for a good villain, and one new movie turns out to be on top of the zeitgeist as well. In theaters across the country today, you can see The International. It stars Naomi Watts and Clive Owen as investigators trying to bring down what is apparently the most evil institution in the world, a multinational bank. NPR's business correspondent Adam Davidson went to a screening.
I'm no movie critic, but I know a bit about banking, and man, oh man, this movie has some really idiotic ideas. Here's a crucial scene. Naomi Watts, the young, gutsy Manhattan assistant district attorney, is questioning the super serious Italian arms manufacturer, played by Luca Barbareschi. She just learned that the evil bank is selling weapons to some African revolutionary, and she wants to know why.
It's about control.
Control the flow of weapons, control the conflict.
No, no, the IBBC is a bank. You see, the real value of a conflict, the true value, is in the debt that it creates. You control the debt, you control everything.
The real value is having a poor African revolutionary army owe you money? I'd rather own some subprime mortgage-backed securities. I actually took a banking expert with me to the movie, Kathleen Scott, banking lawyer with Arnold and Porter.
You have to think about it from a practical standpoint. If you have a penniless revolutionary movement, how are they going to pay back billions of dollars in loans to buy arms?
Yeah, they didn't answer that. That was seemed like a really big question.
Yeah, and you know, I'm sure that it's a little hard to do due diligence on people who probably don't have much money.
If we've learned anything in the last year, it's this. If you control the debt of people who can't pay you back, then you control absolutely nothing. You are, in fact, broke. Understanding banking matters now, probably more than it ever has. And it's not like banks can't be criticized. Some of them have done some pretty lousy stuff, just none of the stuff that's in this movie. Like every few minutes, a bank-hired assassin starts shooting and killing people all over Milan, then New York, then Istanbul. Oh, and another absurdity that Scott points out? It drove her crazy. In the movie, the bank's customer base was not at all diversified. Even evil arms merchant banks try to have a wide range of customers. Scott says, watching the movie, she was really disappointed at how unrealistic it all was. She tried to get lost in the story.
But in your mind, you start thinking, well, if it were a bank, you know, this is how I would have, you know, maybe changed the plot a bit to make it more interesting. And I'm sure, you know...
Like, what would you have done?
I don't know. But something more bank-like, you know, probably, possibly, you know, dealing with sort of, you know, murky debt deals and, you know, bonds and...
You're not selling me, I got to be honest.
I know. I'm not selling you. Well, that's the issue, too.
All right. It's pretty clear why Hollywood departs at least a bit from the real world. The day after seeing the screening, I got to talk to the actual guy who did the actual investigation of the real evil bank, John Moscow. He's the inspiration for the Naomi Watts character, although he notes some differences between himself and her.
You have age, sex, she's pretty, I'm not.
Moscow did work for the Manhattan DA. He did investigate an international banking conspiracy, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, back in the late 80s and early 90s. There was pressure from the feds and the French and many other governments not to pursue the case. And the real BCCI was involved in money laundering, drug sales, arms trafficking, sexual slavery. But his investigation mostly took place in offices, talking on the phone, looking at documents. No shootouts, no kidnappings, no murders.
The exercise of power may not be something that a TV camera can pick up.
In the movie, pretty much every banker and government official was either pure evil or purely good. Moscow says in the real BCCI case, some folks were, in fact, evil. Some were close to being pretty much pure good. Most people, though, of course, were in the middle. In the end, Moscow says, the good guys did win in the real case, although a lot of innocent people lost a lot of money.
The bank was closed. People went to jail. People's lives were tossed into turmoil. These things did happen, but it's very, very complex.
We're going to be spending the next few years trying to figure out what to do with banks. It's suddenly the single most important public policy issue we face. And Moscow's clearly right. The real world of banking is very, very complex. But it would make a lousy movie. Adam Davidson, NPR News, New York.
Earth and Sky.
Oceanographer Eddie Bernard said progress has been made in understanding tsunamis since the one that struck Southeast Asia in 2004. But he said the science of predicting earthquakes, the disturbance that causes 90% of tsunamis, is still unreliable.
It's easy for seismologists to say that an earthquake could occur in the next day or 200 years. But that's not real useful in planning a society.
He offered a way to think of the relationship between an earthquake and a tsunami.
If you think of throwing a rock in a pond, that's a sudden impact on the surface, and then you see waves radiate out from it.
He said the same thing can happen on a planetary scale. An earthquake in the ocean, like a rock in a pond, can create large waves that amplify when they hit the shore. Bernard explained the problem for people who live along coastlines.
No one can tell them exactly when it's going to happen. It'll be abrupt, it'll be sudden, but if you